Everybody, we're going to start the hearing. We are certainly at that time of the session, aren't we? Okay, we've got a little business to take care of at the beginning. We referred 2069 to the floor because, as my recollection is, it was a gut and stuff relating to the issue of... No, maybe it wasn't. A gut and stuff. But we did something to 2069 that included a referral to the floor and then later discovered that it had had a Ways and Means subsequent referral put on it. And by all accounts, it doesn't appear that it needs to. So we're going to have to readdress that issue. Representative Ackerman?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2069.
Representative Ackerman moves that the rules be suspended for reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2069. Is there any objection? The rules are suspended. Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we reconsider the vote by which HB 2069 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Ackerman moves that we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2069 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any objection? Motion carries and the vote has been reconsidered. Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2069 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that we rescind the subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee.
Representative Ackerman moves that House Bill 2069 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the committee rescind the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there discussion? Is there any objection? Motion carries. Representative Ackerman will continue to be the carrier of the bill. All right.
It wasn't on my cue cards. I didn't know if I was supposed to debate the bill or not. So.
Yeah, well, yeah, it wasn't on the script. All the motions said non-debatable, Floyd. Okay, with that piece of work being done, we're going to jump over 2094 for a couple of minutes, so we're going to go right into a work session on 2238. I'll open a work session at Council. Can you bring us up to speed?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you should have the dashboard amendments, which we just got about a half hour ago. And what this does is it rewrites the whole bill. And you have some material in front of you, a sheet that I got from Scott Tye, which basically tells you what the amendments do. They make the following changes to the current Public Safety Memorial Fund. It sets 1 through 6. Mr. Tye is here if you have any questions. I know that there are some people here who would like to... comment on the record here. I know Brian the Lashmitz would like to make some comments for the purposes of the record. I think the issue they would like to clarify on the record is whether if someone is in the program now receiving benefits and the amendments take effect, the bill takes effect in January 1 of 2003, it's their understanding that those people will be treated the same way they are now.
Okay.
So people who are receiving benefits, this bill will not impact them, and they'd like to make some statement on the record.
Well, why don't you come up? Do you have anybody with you that you want to bring up? Brian, you're going to comment. Is there anybody else here who intended to make a comment about the amendments to House Bill 2238? Okay, so we've got the three of you here. Why don't we go ahead and have Scott bring us up to speed on what the department's recommending, and then we'll go to Brian.
Okay.
Or Scott, your guest, and everybody needs to be sure to identify themselves for the record.
Okay. excuse me. For the record, my name is Scott Tye. I'm the Standards and Certification Director for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. And with me on my right is Marilyn Lawrence, who is our Public Relations Coordinator. Is that right?
Close enough. Government liaison.
And to my left, Brian
Lashman.
Yeah, we recognize Brian. It's Marilyn right. that we're not familiar with.
I'm a frequent visitor here.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Scott. Why don't you tell us what the amendments do?
Okay, Chair Williams, members of the committee, the key provisions of the amendments to House Bill 2238 adds those officers that may be permanently totally disabled to be eligible for the $25,000 lump sum benefit that currently is only available to those public safety officers who are killed in line of duty. It also changes the discretionary portion of the bill for the $25,000 award to a mandatory. You'll see in the language where it changes it to the board shall award rather than may award. The third key provision is it adds parents to the definition of who is eligible to receive a death benefit. Under current definition, parents are not eligible to receive the death benefit. And we've had occasions in the past where a public safety officer was killed in the line of duty, and that public safety officer did not have a spouse or children, and then the parents wound up having to incur the financial burden of all the costs that go to that would be involved with an officer being killed in line of duty. The fourth key provision would be that all other benefits are discretionary, meaning the scholarship benefit and the mortgage benefit, except that health and dental was mandatory. And originally the bill was intended to have the death benefit be mandatory and the health and dental be permissive. And what this bill does is it places the health and dental into the discretionary category to allow the board to make awards. Fifth, the bill changes the scholarship awards and makes the awards secondary to the federal program. It allows for a person who goes through the federal program to apply for graduate benefits, and it also provides a safety net provision where if someone applies for the federal benefit and is denied or possibly the federal program changes, they can then apply to the board and receive undergraduate tuition. And finally, the key provision is it establishes procedures for the board to establish or award benefits. One question we did have that Council Taylor indicated was in Section 12, we wanted to make sure that the provision in Section 12 allows us by rule to adequately address those issues where we may have a person that's currently receiving benefits. An example I'd like to use is we have a college student who's a sophomore, and then the following year she or he would make application for benefits for her junior or his junior year, but has not received approval from the federal government on an award for a scholarship benefit. We want to make sure that by rule we have the ability to protect that person and protect their benefits to make sure that they can continue with their college education.
Okay. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Marilyn, before we move on, do you have something to add?
Chair Williams, I'm here to answer questions. I worked with Legislative Council to draft the amendments to the bill, and so if the committee has any questions about any other provisions that we haven't addressed, I'd be happy to try and answer those for you.
Okay. And before I go to Representative Jensen, why don't we let Mr. DeLashman put his point on the record, and then we'll open it up for questions.
For the record, Brian DeLashman, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, and the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers. Actually, I think you've had a pretty thorough discussion or explanation of what this bill does. But let me just take you back just a step. The original bill, if you recall, had basically a major revision to the existing program in which it was a $75,000 lump sum, and then basically you were out of the business. And the Oregon Council of Police Associations and my other clients objected to that. There was subsequent discussions between the DPSSP, the governor's office, and other interested parties, including the firefighters and myself. And this is the product of those discussions. There was actually, I think, two major goals we're trying to accomplish. One is the technical changes on the may and the shall, which have been described to you. The $25,000 is now a must, but the others are, in fact, permissive, which I think was the intent of the original bill when we passed it. That is accomplished in this. The other goal we had, without trying to dilute any of the benefits, was to figure out a way that we were meshing the federal programs and other programs so that we could save the state some dollars on the scholarship piece, where there was already a federal program that had been implemented, at the same time make sure that we weren't going to have some people drop through the cracks if there was not a federal program available or somehow they didn't qualify. And the one additional change then beyond that was that we did expand it so if they did access the federal program for their undergraduate, they would have the ability to qualify or make application to this fund, given available funds for a graduate program. As was indicated both by Scott and by Council Taylor, the only concern or only question we had, and we think that by mentioning it in this hearing, having obviously the approval of this committee on what your intent is, under Section 12, what we want to do is be able to catch some folks as we go through this transition. We do not want somebody who's already in the college scholarship program to all of a sudden be out of the business of going to school, which is what both the state and the federal program was intended to do. And with that, I'll answer any questions.
Okay. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's not a question as such, but something more of a concern. Page 5 of the Dash 1 Amendment, line 5. I worry a little bit about the language of this for 5 years or until the spouse remarries. Now, I would like to point out that my concern with this has nothing to do with a moral value that I might have or moral values I might not have in relationship to marriage. Simply to point out to the committee that the inclusion of language like this might inhibit a spouse from remarrying until that 5-year period has expired. And again, forgetting the moral arguments of marriage or as such, I think most people in family therapy, RE, that general area of work, would concede or would agree that they that where there are children involved, that remarriage is probably better than cohabitation. I would be more comfortable if language were simply for 5 years or if there were some way to exclude the marriage element in there.
Okay, thanks for putting those comments on the record, Representative Jensen. Anybody want to respond to those?
Actually, Mr. Chair, my recollection is that this is just the reformatting of how the current statute is, that's the way the current statute is as far as the 5 years or the remarriage. So legislative council in redrafting this has reorganized this whole thing, and the reason why it shows up in the bold is just, in fact, it's being reorganized in a different place.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Jensen.
In which case, it's an excellent opportunity to amend a existing statute.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Jensen. Given the time nature that we're in with respect to House bills, it's an issue that I won't disagree with you on, but is one that I would suggest perhaps we do in the Senate if it's going to be done. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Totally disabled. I'm just curious, what does that mean? Because I know there's people, for example, that work in the city of Portland who may have their hand hurts or something, so they're considered totally disabled and given full disability benefits. Would they qualify for this?
Chair Williams, Representative Barker, just a simple hand injury I do not believe would qualify for that. The definition is totally permanently disabled. And we pretty much mirror the federal definition.
Unable to do any work.
Unable to do any work.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I just have a point. I know I brought this up before, and that was to make sure that there's some protection to the minor or minor children that may have an opportunity to be awarded the benefit under section, I think it's section 11. I raised these concerns last time, and I don't want to hold up the bill for this, but I'd either like your reaction to it or see if it might be worthy of some correction in the Senate, particularly since on page 3 that it says another person may file an application on behalf of the eligible person, meaning a minor. I'm kind of worried about that. And then I'm also worried about if an award is made to a minor under Section 11, that you do not provide for it being paid to an appropriate conservator. I don't know how you handle that practically, but I know in handling funds for minor clients of any substantial degree, it usually requires a conservatorship to complete that process. I don't know if you do that in practice or if it's something you probably could consider working out in the Senate, but it could produce some liability problems for the fund if you didn't adequately provide the funds to the children under these circumstances.
Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman, and for the record officially, my name is Marilyn Lawrence. I'm the government liaison for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Representative Ackerman, I believe there is a provision in the current bill that if somebody is receiving funds on behalf of another party, the board may require them to file an annual accounting and have some other procedures. I can't find the exact spot on the page now, but I am confident that was included as the bill was rewritten. I know that has been in the original provisions for the Public Safety Memorial Fund.
Okay.
Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman, if you look on page 10, Section 6, line 15, the new subsection 1, you see that this sets forth procedures where the board has the authority to require the payee to file an annual accounting of the award with the board to assure that the monies that are awarded to a minor child would be protected and spent properly.
Okay. I'm still suggesting that conservatorship is probably provides better protection for the minor, but I think you have that covered and you can work that out someplace else.
Okay.
I don't want to hold up the bill on that. We've made the record.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen, I move the Dash 1 amendment. Thank you. Representative Jensen moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2238. Is there any further discussion? Any objection? Dash 1s are adopted. Representative Jensen?
I move House Bill 2238 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Jensen moves House Bill 2238 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on his motion? Hearing none. And call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Aye.
Representative
Trumbull?
Aye.
Representative
McPherson?
Aye.
Representative
Brzezinski? Aye.
Representative Jennerly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Atherton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2238 as amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Volunteer carrier.
Okay.
Representative Jensen, even with the marriage provision.
I will make that point on the whole floor.
I bet you will. That's all right, though. I think you'll do a good job carrying the bill. So, all right. Representative Jensen to carry 2238. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2711. Council?
In a second, Mr. Chair.
That's all right. Representative Shetterly needs time to finish chewing his cookie.
No, I got that done before the vote. Thank you.
Sort of.
Mr. Chairman,
sort of.
This bill modifies provisions relating to collection of child support payments by collection agencies. What it does is it. We had a TAP hearing on this on Friday, and Ronell Schenkel is here to give you more detail. But the main part of the bill is currently. Private collection agency can collect 20% for the work that they do. And from what I understand, that may not be sufficient enough to encourage some of the larger companies to come here. And what the Dash 1 amendment does, with the bill is raise that fee to 29% and also put in some other protections concerning in the line of consumer protection, the size of the pipe and what has to be in the agreement. But Ranella is here, and I'm sure she can tell you more about it.
Ms. Schenkel, do you want to come forward? Is this the first time you've been back to committee since you got wheeled out on the stretcher?
It is.
We won't be that hard this time.
She does look more alive today.
Well, our greatest concern was that she'd recently visited China. I mean, so, but I think she's doing better now. We're glad to see you back, and glad to see you well.
Thank you, Chair Williams, members of the committee. In fact, I'm feeling so well, I was just sitting in the back of the room talking to Mr. Marquis about whether or not we could hold hands and skip up to the table again on this bill today, but that's for another day. I am passing out to you a hand-engrossed copy of some proposed amendments on House Bill 2711 and testimony from the Department of Justice Division of Child Support on behalf of the Child Support Program, as well as testimony that was shared with us by the Council on National Council on Private Collection Agencies that they wish to get on the record. I'm happy to give you additional information to that that Mr. Taylor has given you, or simply answer questions, so I would ask for direction from the Chair on your preference.
Well, Ranelle, we have a set of Dash 1 amendments in front of us. Are the Dash 1 amendments essentially the impact of the hand growth that we're seeing?
Chair Williams, that is correct. What occurred was the Department of Justice worked with Representative Patridge, and he was kind enough to sponsor this bill. We had some preliminary information based on meetings that had occurred during the interim national meetings with child support programs across the states, as well as private collection agencies and the Commissioner of Child Support herself. Then what occurred after the bill draft came out was Representative Patridge had a conference call with our agency, as well as some of the private collection agencies, and the result were the Dash 1 amendments. We support the Dash 1 amendments. They are shown to you in that hand-engrossed version that I just distributed.
Thank you. Colleagues, so you understand, and I indicated that I would do this, the folks from the Child Support Enforcement Council, which is the testimony that you're being presented today, along with gentlemen, I'm trying to remember, see if I can get the name of the individual. I don't know that I can. I had a telephone conference the first thing this morning. Here it is. It's a Mr. Eric Rosenkoder, I think is how you pronounce his name. They are the association generally that represents the collection agencies that do private enforcement of child support collections. They had originally sent correspondence, which some of you may have in your file, opposing the bill, primarily because the bill capped the fees which they would be allowed to recover at 29%. Earlier, a session ago, we adopted legislation which capped the fees at 20%. They withdrew their objection to the fee cap concept generally and agreed to a fee cap, but their recommendation and their wish and their contingent support of the bill would only be if we raised the fee cap from 29% to 35%, and that was the request they made to me over the telephone today. They're obviously out of state now here in person. I indicated that I would make that information available to the committee. And I also spoke to Representative Patridge, who is the sponsor of the bill, who indicated to me that he was satisfied with the Dash 1 amendments, which put the fee cap at 29%. So in the interest of full disclosure, you all know now the same thing I know about the fee cap issue. Representative Brzezinski?
I wonder if we could have a discussion as to that payment of that collection fee. Who's on the hook for that?
Chair Williams, Representative Brzezinski, my understanding of the way that most of these private collection agencies work when it comes to child support is that at the time the obligee comes to them and is looking to sign a contract with that agency, they talk about the terms and the fee or the percentage. They will tell that obligee up front, your debt today is $10,000. For us to work your case, we would take a 20% fee. And so they actually come up with a dollar figure that the obligee is willing to say, if you collect this, this percentage goes to you and the remainder to myself. So if that answers your question, ultimately it's coming out of a portion of the arrears owed to that custodial parent or that obligee, but it's based on that obligee's consent up front that that will occur. The child support program, just to clarify for you, is not a party to that contract, and we are not contracting with the collection agencies. What you have in Oregon's law that, in fact, we are being nationally recognized for is a very unique partnership that the legislators last session set up, where the child support program is still providing services, but a collection agency may be as well, and we do so in tandem and in coordination.
Their argument on the phone today was simply that some of them, they didn't think it, even 29% would find it lucrative to come into the market. Representative Patridge seems to indicate that he thinks that some of them will at 29% come into the market, and that's just a choice that the individual private companies will get to make. Their point often is as well that they often go after the almost uncollectible kinds of debt, the stuff that you can just sort of catch by easily electronic scanning of records and tax returns, that's not likely where they're going to, you know, they don't get those clients. They get the people who are really under deep cover, you know, in a bunker somewhere, and they track them down and figure out how to get their money. So anyway, that was the sense of the discussion. But as I said, I conferred with the sponsor of the bill today, who said he supported the Dash 1 amendments and the current fee cap at 29% in its original form. So that's the information that the committee has in front of it. Further questions or comments, Ms. Schenkel?
This may help. There's another piece that is very technical, but just in addition to that fee cap, in the Dash 1 amendments, there is actually some proposed exception language. That was a result of the conference call. The 29% comes from a General Accounting Office report last year that the national average at that time for private collection agencies working on child support cases was 29%. That's the average. That's where the representative got that fee. The exception language in the amendment would allow them to exceed that 29% cap if it were for the purpose of hiring an attorney to help assist in representing the obligee and enforcing those collection efforts. So there is an exception proposed in the amendments before you to the 29%, but it's tied to the need to use private counsel.
Representative Fusansky?
I'd like to just, I guess, get something on the record as to how this procedure works. My understanding, we have a person who's obligated by an Oregon court to pay child support. They fail to pay it. It goes in arrears. Then the department uses its best effort to try to collect it. At some point, let's say those arrears continue to grow. Collection is little to none. And then are we saying the individual who is the creditor then goes out and seeks assistance from one of the collection agencies, or is it your department that's going to be kind of working with the agency saying we have these outstanding obligations from these different debtors? I'm trying to get a connection. I mean, to me, what I'm hearing right now is that we got a court order that's trying to be enforced. We have a organization that's going to at least take 29% away from the child to get whatever they can get collected. And on top of that, there's an exception now, not knowing what that exception amount is, for attorney fees to go after the collections, which could mean 30%, 45% of the outstanding debt that this Oregon court required to be paid is now going to a collection agency.
Chair Williams, Representative Pozanski, you are going exactly down the line of discussion that was held by House Judiciary Committee last session when this bill first originated in Oregon. It was anticipated by the testimony of that committee, as well as by the child support program at the time, that in Oregon, in fact, on the record, they were very kind to us. They said, you do a great job, you have a lot of tools, but we know you cannot do it all, Oregon child support program. In that case, obligee should have an option to go out and seek this additional resource. The partnership piece that is drafted in the statute requires the program to first get notice of that and have the opportunity to say, yes, it is acceptable for you to start taking collection actions, private collection agency, because we're not. The attempt there was some consumer protection, so to speak, on the obligor side of the equation. We don't want to be doing income withholding, tax offset, and on top of that have another company come in and collect towards that same debt. So that is a piece of, I think, the concern I hear for you, Representative. But it is true that a portion of the funds that are owed to the obligee, not to the state, but to that custodial parent or the judgment creditor, are being given up, so to speak, for this service. We've tried to build in some pieces by requiring notice and 12-point font and those sorts of things for the collection agencies to make it really clear when the obligees are making that choice. And, in fact, in the existing law, what occurs is when we get a request to acknowledge that a private collection agency has been contracted by an obligee, before we actually set this up on our system to acknowledge that and let funding go through them, a notice goes out from the program that reminds the obligees you're entitled to this service for free by the Oregon Child Support Program. So because of a variety of factors we've tried to build into the laws, or I should say you have built into the laws for us, we hope that it is those cases where they need that extra help. And I think there was some pretty some testimony at one of the national meetings that I brought back to the Child Support Program, and I will share with you. There was a small company that's run by a woman who used to be an obligee, and she stood up and said, I'll tell you, after 20-some years, letting somebody have 30% of my debt was way better than the 0% of everything I got. Some obligees are willing to do this in order to get some form of collection on those difficult cases.
It is, Representative Brzezinski, a little bit like saying that, you know, 30% of, or 70% of something is better than 100% of nothing. And it's not, in some ways, unlike a situation like you and I encounter in our civil practice, where after having obtained a judgment, against a party on behalf of a client, there's only so much you can do, and at times your client goes out then and hires a private collection agency to track down that judgment debtor, who may be in many various parts of the country, knowing that they're going to take, you know, some loss as a result of that on the judgment that the court awarded them. And it was a policy discussion that we had to some considerable degree in the last legislative session. So, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm kind of struggling with this, and we are in work session, I think, so we can not necessarily addressing a question on it. But it sounds to me a little bit like somebody wanting to get a loan sharks collection agency into the into the system. My inclination right now it would be to, I think, proceed with the 29%, and if this proves to be inadequate, the proponents can come back to a subsequent legislative session and say this didn't work because the percentage was not enough, example A, B, and C. Sort of thing. So I think probably many of these people are somewhat at the mercy of the collection agency that's negotiating with them, because they have gone without this money, and 50% of something is better than 100% of nothing too, where in fact it might be better than that, but might not be warranted. And so unless somebody can tell me differently, my inclination is to honor the sponsor's recommendation on this bill and not amend it to 35%.
Thank you, Representative Jensen. Is there any other discussion or questions for Ms. Shankle? Representative Brzezinski.
Mr. Chair, I do want to put this on the record, because my biggest concern is I understand how this process works, and I'm not saying we shouldn't go there. But at the same time, knowing how tight money is getting in our system, what I don't want to see the next thing is that we start cutting back on the money that's going to Department of Justice to perform their job, mm-hmm. to the point, because now we've got private collectors that can be hired to go out and do this, and did not think we were doing a disservice to the individuals. And I'm not saying that's happening now, but my concern is that if we don't take care of the revenue issues that we need to, we are potentially going to be looking at where do we shave, and here's a place that we can cut back because we know there's other recourse for somebody.
Okay. All right, thank you. We are in work session. We have the Dash 1 amendments in front of us.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen.
I'll move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2711.
Representative Jensen moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2711. Is there further discussion? Any objection? The Dash 1s are in. Representative Jensen.
I'll move House Bill 2711 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Jensen moves House Bill 2711 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? Okay, Ann, call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative
Kummel?
Excused.
Representative
Pearson? Aye.
Representative Pozanski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2711 is amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Volunteer on this one? We gave Representative Jensen the last one on the Public Safety Memorial Fund, so anybody else want to step up? Two in a row, Bob?
Sure.
All right.
We'll do our best to make it sound like these are on the consent calendar.
Yeah, right.
Just humble.
Okay, we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2756.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2756 was sponsored by the Judiciary Committee, and this was a product of a work group during the interim session, and it modifies provisions relating to relief and requirements to report sex offenders reporting based on a juvenile adjudication. You have the Dash 1 amendments in front of you, and the main thing the Dash 1 amendments do is they remove the right to counsel. There's no constitutional right to counsel in these hearings, and this bill has otherwise would have a very, very large fiscal impact, well above the $50,000 limitation. And they also provide a filing fee for anyone seeking to have the restrictions of the requirement that they register as an offender removed before the court. And that's for the purposes of reducing the fiscal impact on this. Mr. Travis, we spoke to me before the meeting and said something about that he thought this bill would have to go to Ways and Means Committee so their budget could be reconciled, because even though there's a filing fee, the money does not go to the courts. So I don't know what this is a new one to me, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Why don't we is there anyone here to speak in favor of the Dash 1 amendments or to bring the committee up to speed on the impact of the Dash 1s? Sarah, you want to come and take a seat?
Certainly, answer some questions for you.
You were looking for other people to stand
I
up.
I was looking for other people. I was hoping that there would be other members that had been part of this interim session. I wasn't personally part of it, but have been in constant discussions with Mr. Duell, who was the district attorney that was representing ODAA.
Great. Well, we appreciate you. We appreciate you stepping up. Kelly, you want to come sit up at the table, too?
A little bit.
All right. Well, good. Sounds like we got the B team in here today on this bill, but we're willing to have you.
I know a little bit, too.
I've heard people say that.
But not about this.
Okay. I think what we need, we did have testimony, committee, you might recall, back on the 19th of March. We had a panel that included some folks from, as I recall, state police. Were they in on it? Was state police and OIA and the DAs.
That's right. Mr. Duell was here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association.
So tell us what... generally the Dash 1 amendments do, and tell us whether or not they're consensus amendments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's my understanding from a discussion with Mr. Duell that these are consensus amendments from this committee. This was a way to deal with an enormous fiscal. I'm confident there are members of this consortium committee that feel like this is we're working on trying to get this through to start working to see how many of these petitions we actually come to the courts. And so I think this is a way to start the process and see how many youths who have been adjudicated as sex offenders and therefore have to register as required by law, how many actually petition the courts, and see what kind of numbers we have and see how this process works, because it's not something, it's something that's a little bit new.
Okay, Kelly?
And this, again, was Ms. Swenson's project, but I did attend a couple meetings with her, and I wanted to remind the committee that last session the original bill was passed, which allowed it allowed juveniles who had been adjudicated on sex offenses prior to or after the effective date of that act last session to apply for relief from registration, and this bill would expand that to those people who whose adjudication who completed their supervision on that adjudication prior to the effectiveness of that last act. It also includes a provision to allow out-of-state offenders. So currently, if you move to Oregon, you have a juvenile adjudication for a sex offense from another state, you would be required to register for life under Oregon law, and this allows those out-of-state offenders to apply here. And you'll note that there are different burdens of proof depending on whether the person's out of state and whether it's an old adjudication. The burden would then be on the person applying for relief, as opposed to the more current petitioners who have just become eligible for relief. The burden would still be on the district attorney's assist, or the district attorney.
Okay. Are there questions for either of these two? Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Am I reading this correctly? If it's a major 11 crime and they agree not to be tried as an adult, they agree to not remove, not to be taken off the, they agree to register for life?
Well, it depends on what the negotiation is with the county district attorney. In Marion County, where I practice, that is sometimes part of the agreement. We agree not to prosecute this as a ballot measure 11 offense, allow you to be adjudicated in juvenile court, but as part of that agreement, you're agreeing to a lifetime registration requirement. And so it just depends on the facts and circumstances of each individual case and the county's policy. Each district attorney in the state has a little different policy and application, and so it just will depend on what the agreement is as to that particular use. But it allows for us to continue to be able to do that. That was, I think, a deal breaker almost from the ODAA perspective for this bill.
Well, you have more friends than you knew, because they just sort of keep popping out here. You want to put yourself on the record for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dan Malin with the Oregon State Police. I was here as part of the original panel.
I remember that.
Supported the bill, and we still support the bill. I just wanted to make a couple of points. Number one, one of the key points about the bill was the fact that it provides for consistent relief for registration across the board for all juveniles, as opposed to the two different relief avenues that we have now. Number two, there was some concern and some calculations made as to the great fiscal expense of this bill. I just wanted to remind the chair and the committee that this bill, if passed, would actually push out petitions for relief from registrations to 2 years from the end of supervision. Under the current statute, they must request relief within 90 days from the end of supervision. This bill would actually push out petitions for relief from registration into not the 03-05 biennium, but the one that follows. So there are some economic realities to this bill that should be considered. It would provide an avenue for those juvenile offenders who were adjudicated outside of Oregon who have been off of supervision for at least 2 years, to file their petition, an opportunity that under the last legislative session, it's questionable as to whether or not they have that opportunity or not. So the fiscal reality I wanted to point out was this pushes these petitions to the court out 2 years in advance. That's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thanks, Dan. Counsel?
Chair, I can also give the committee some further history on this bill. In 1999, the legislature passed this bill. One of the reasons was it was tied to federal burn grants. What was ambiguous at that time was whether the federal requirement applied both to adults and juveniles, and it turned out it just applied to adults. So since that time, we've started to make modifications to the juvenile requirement of lifetime registration.
Okay, committee, are there other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Appreciate you. Dan, next time you'll have to wear your hat. You're a lot easier to recognize when you got that Mountie hat on. Mr. Travis. Share with us your concerns.
Timothy Travis, Oregon Judicial Department, between the rock and the hard place. Talk about the B team. Here I am. First of all, let me make clear the courts were not invited to this party. We were not part of the work group. Nobody talked to us as this bill was written. Senate Bill 307 that passed last session and gave a limited universe of kids the right to ask that they be excused from the duty to register included the right to counsel. The kids eligible today under 307 who have the right to counsel will come under this bill and lose the right to counsel. So kids who today have the right to counsel and asking for their duty to be excused will lose their right to counsel because they will be swept into this larger universe that has no right to counsel. I didn't see the amendment with the $300 fee today, but I did some quick calculations. Our fiscal on this for the courts, which includes a discount for the cases that were mentioned that will be pushed out 2 years, our fiscal was from $59,000 to $294,000, depending on the assumptions that you made, and I'm presuming you all have a copy of this fiscal with you. Even factoring in the $300 fee...
Well, excuse me, Tim, how would we have had it?
Well, we send it in.
Well, sending it in to LFO doesn't necessarily mean that this committee has it.
I'm sorry, I made an assumption. I'm sorry. I'll be glad to provide the committee with copies. I only have my one copy here with me now. But let me make the point that even with a $300 fee, this bill still has a fiscal, I just did some quick calculations, in the range of $34,839 to $172,525. So it's not under the fiscal limit except at the lower end. And as I said to the council earlier, the court, of course, will not get this fee, so our court operations fees are not offset by the collection of this fee unless we get a budgetary allotment to cover these costs. It's been agreed by the OCDLA and, as the committee counsel said earlier, that there's no right to counsel for these kids constitutionally. I wish that decision could be made today, but that decision ultimately will be made in a building over there. And people from the OCDLA will be the ones who will be bringing the suits to try to establish that there's a right to counsel. So there may well be a huge fiscal on this bill having to do with right to counsel, which will be a major hit taken by indigent defense in the interim if it's found. So we don't know, but we do know that we have a potential problem out there. This bill has a 5-year limit on it. If a young person does not make their application within 5 years of the time that they're eligible, they lose the ability to petition. So if they don't have the $300 in the 5 years and they don't have a right to counsel, they will not be able to do this. The last thing I want to say is that they'll have, actually the second to last thing I want to say is these kids will have one shot at this. If they go in without a lawyer and lose, then they have taken their one shot. Now, the last thing I want to say about this is that there's been some talk that I'm trying to kill this bill with a fiscal, that I personally am trying to kill this bill with a fiscal. People on this committee who have been in this building for a while know that I sat in this chair for three sessions and fought registration of juvenile sex offenders tooth and nail. I'm not trying to kill this bill with a fiscal. Another thing that's been said is that the Judicial Department is trying to kill this bill with a fiscal. I find it funny that people in this building and in this audience will accuse the judges of doing everything they can to work around sex offender registration and then say that the judges are trying to kill a bill that would excuse the duty to register as sex offenders. One of the nice things about having a 9-year-old daughter is that I get reminded of some things that I once knew but I've forgotten. Recently I watched her do an experiment with a balloon, little balloon. She put it on a water tap and she turned the water on. It's amazing how much water will fit into that balloon. But there comes a point at which that experiment and how much water will fit in the balloon turns into an experiment of how long it's going to take you to mop the water off the floor. And by jamming a huge fiscal into a court budget that already has water all over the floor, all that's happening is that we're going to slow down processes even more. So I'm asking this court that the court does not have an opinion about the substance of this fiscal, but we have grave concerns about the cost of it and the way that they're not going to be built into our budget for the next biennium. So that's all I have to say.
Counsel?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, after the last meeting, two of the proponents of the bill, Ingrid Swenson and Kathy Berger, came to my office and asked to get a note to Mother to get amendments for the bill. And then they thought long and hard about it as it relates to the right to counsel. There is not a constitutional right to counsel here. These are people, lawyers, who represent kids in these proceedings, now adults in these proceedings. And they thought long and hard about it, and they basically decided to go ahead with the amendment to remove the right to counsel because even though there will be a cost for these people, they'd rather have the process than not have the process. Also, they attempted to put a filing fee on here to address the fiscal impact as they understood it to be. So they're not here today to address those issues, but I thought I'd relay those issues to you from the conversations I had with them. So they did their best-faced effort to try to cover the costs here.
Mr. Chair, if I may?
Yeah.
I would feel better about the OCDLA saying that there's no right to counsel if they were willing to go on the record to say that they would not, that they, if a challenge to the no right to counsel provision is made in the Court of Appeals, that the OCDLA will file a friend of the court brief saying that there's no right to counsel.
Well, I'm not going to make Ms. Skye come up and speak for Ms. Swenson's bill on that subject. Well, okay, here's what the chair is going to do. We're going to close the work session on this bill until we can get these issues resolved, at least to hopefully mine and the committee's satisfaction. So I'll close the work session on House Bill 2756. Going to open a work session on House Bill 2865. Counsel?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this committee passed this bill out a couple of days ago. Well, excuse me, it adopted a set of amendments, the Dash 1 amendments, and there was an issue around the testimony before the grand jury. The proposal as written would have allowed hearsay evidence where a police officer's report would allow the report being introduced by another party, except for that part of the evidence that was hearsay in itself, so hearsay upon hearsay. The committee had several questions about that, and I know Representative Przanski in particular did. What we now have are three sets of amendments, which we had adopted the Dash 1, which means we'd have to rescind them. And these contain everything that the Dash 1 amendments contain except for one thing, and that relates to grand juries. And the Dash 2 amendments would basically say someone else could testify if they were involved, another police officer, if involved in the criminal investigation under the grand jury. The Dash 3 amendments would remove the section, and the Dash 4 amendments would allow hearsay where, for example, it was in the chain of custody. On the Dash 4 amendments, it's on lines 12 through 16. If the official report contains inadmissible hearsay of persons other than the person who compiled the official report, the inadmissible hearsay may not be presented to the grand jury under this subsection.
Okay.
Excuse me, I should have started above the 10. Except as otherwise provided in the subsection, a grand jury may receive evidence through testimony of a police officer, information from an official report of a person concerning the chain of custody evidence being presented to the grand jury.
So it's the dash fours of the chain of custody hearsay.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
The dash threes are?
They remove the whole section, so you would not be an issue.
No grand jury issue
grand
at all.
Jury.
And the dash twos?
The dash two were the ones that we discussed at the last meeting. Police officers involved in the criminal investigation under the grand jury inquiry. So, for example, it couldn't be a police officer who's stationed there all the time reading someone else's police, another police officer's report. It would have to be someone who's part of the investigation.
Okay.
Now we have Chuck French from Multnomah DA's office. He's the one that addressed the issue
right.
on behalf of the DA's. Susan Russell was here the last time, but I do see Kelly Skye here on the issue.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Przanski.
Just for clarification, the dash one did not even address the grand jury issue. It was the other two issues, and that one stayed the same, correct? And so when we passed the dash ones, is that?
No, I don't think that's right.
No, the dash two, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, did not, you're right, it did not address the grand jury issue, so it stayed the same as in the original
bill. In the original bill.
Right. Sorry, as adopted, it left the grand jury issue the same.
Yeah, if I remember, the bill has three components to it.
Right.
And dash one only addressed component one and component three.
Okay. So we don't need to rescind from the dash ones. We want the dash ones in regardless of what we do with
well,
the grand jury.
No, Mr. Chairman, as a committee, what I did is I combined the dash one and all the other amendments.
Oh, okay. So it's duplicated in two, three, and four.
Because when we file a bill, they have to be combined anyways, and that would delay the process a couple
okay.
of days.
All right. Well, so regardless of what we do, we need to rescind the dash one amendments. So the chair would, Representative Barker then moves that we rescind the dash one amendments from House Bill 2865. Anybody object? Because I already banged the gavel. All right. So those amendments are out. So now we're looking at the two, threes, and fours.
Mr. Chair, I'll just get maybe the discussion started. Because I talked to a couple of members and asked them what's their position. I don't know if Representative McPherson would like to share some of his concerns that he and I spoke about, and maybe we just have the dialogue before we figure which of these would be maybe where the committee may want to go.
Mr. Chair,
Representative McPherson,
I would just describe what I took away from our last the discussion of this the other day and the presentation that we heard is that where the information being provided by a different police officer goes to chain of custody of evidence, that it seemed to me that was entirely appropriate to have that presented by someone who was there and who's not present. The person, the presenter, not having personal knowledge, that's the point. And that when we go to other points of evidence, I would rather have the person who generated the input being there in person rather than relying on hearsay. So that's the distinction I would draw, that is, allow it for chain of custody but not otherwise. Now, I didn't absorb from the presentation here today just which of these amendments draws that distinction in the way that Representative Przanski and I had discussed.
Well, I think that would be the dash fours, would it not? I think the dash fours are the chain of custodies. The dash threes, it removes the whole section related to the grand jury discussion in its entirety. And the dash twos allows for a police officer involved in that particular investigation to represent the investigating team at the grand jury.
Mr. Chair, by deleting the whole discussion of the grand jury, what's the effect of the dash three?
I think the dash three means you get sections one and three of the bill, and you don't do section two at all.
Oh, okay. So we would not then be able to, even for chain of custody purposes, be able to use a different police officer.
That's
status,
correct.
Yeah, okay. It'd be status quo.
It'd be status quo.
Okay. Well, I would be in favor of the dash fours then.
Representative Barker, you have a thought?
I'm a little bit lost here where we are. So if I advise somebody of their rights, do I have to be there to say I advise him of his rights when he confessed to Prozanski? Or can Prozanski say, Barker advised him of his rights, and then he told me this?
I think under the dash fours, you have to be there in person to say you advise them of their rights. Under the dash twos, if you told Prozanski, Prozanski could say, because he was in the investigation, he could present your report. So that's the dash twos.
Right. And I also think that, I mean, the way, well, I can only speak for myself in grand juries, a lot of this stuff is pretty well just straight out on the table as to, and these are not really issues that are before the grand jury as to, you know, advice of rights and such. I mean, to me it seemed that what we're trying to do is accommodate on the scale that we can the cost for having a lot of officers, and as Representative Barker says, Portland, I mean, I hate to say this because I think I have more officers in Eugene and Florence that are going to want to go to work in Portland, because if they get four-hour callbacks, that's a heck of a lot better than I think what they do in the other two cities. And so in the chain of custody, I mean, that really is basically pretty technical stuff, and you're just really trying to put what you need to on the record to have the jury true belt the individual. And then you're going to have all of those issues still before the court for deliberation as to on the legal grounds as well as on the factual grounds. And
so it's really, in my view, colleagues, it's a choice between essentially the twos and the fours.
So twos were able, an officer involved in the investigation is able to testify off the other officers.
Look, report. I've got some Republicans coming back to the committee. Representative Barker.
How long?
Representative Shetterly was on the phone. No vote side on this one.
Yeah, I know, I know. I just was starting to feel a little lonely, Bob. Thanks for coming back.
I mean, you're an intimidating figure anyway.
Yeah. Well, I'm something. Maybe not that. Go ahead, Representative Barker.
Well, maybe I ask counsel, where are we? So what? Tell me what happens A or B, two or four on this. As far as what the officer...
Okay.
I mean, the idea behind this was to be able to go into grand jury with one officer who was involved and not have everybody come in and say, I did a little part, I did a little part. Just okay. Twos will allow that.
The bill as drafted would allow a police officer to testify onto what another police officer said. So you have a police report. Yeah. Now, you mentioned you gave him the Miranda warning. Okay, I think that would be a lot admissible. His response, unless he's hearsay within hearsay, unless somehow allowed in another rule, would not be admissible. Okay, that's the current law, the proposal. It wouldn't matter whether you're involved in the investigation or not. The dash two amendments would say same scenario, but you'd have to be involved in the investigation.
Okay.
And then the four would be the chain of custody issue.
Only
the chain of custody.
And twos would include chain of custody. Right. Twos would include chain of custody and a few other things.
Cuts a broader swath.
Right. Okay.
Fours narrow it just to the issue of chain of custody.
Okay.
It could, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
So,
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I think we have to remind ourselves that the standard in a grand jury proceeding is just based upon probable cause, and I think that the dash two amendments provide enough reliability for me to support the admission of this type of hearsay evidence, because it is limited to an officer who's involved in the same inquiry that's the subject of the grand jury process. So even though it would also involve a chain of custody, I think still there's some inherent reliability in the reports of those police officers in this setting. So I would support the dash twos.
Okay. I'm going to go ahead to move this along, since I think we understand sort of what the dynamic is. I'm going to take that as a motion on the adoption of the dash two amendments to House Bill 2865. Open it up for any further discussion, but I want to I figure this is one where we're just call a vote and then see how we come down. And if we can't adopt the dash twos, then we'll talk about the dash fours.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Well, I'm fine, but this is just looking on page two. It's just kind of interesting drafting. It says that if a birth certificate for the defendant was never created, the court shall ask the defendant under oath or affirmation to give the defendant's true name, suggest that the court is asking under oath or affirmation.
No, these were in the dash ones from last week, so don't get us talking about something that we did last time.
They're curious.
Yeah, who swears the court?
Yeah.
Okay. So the motion is the adoption of the dash twos. Representative Przanski.
I would just throw a question out that I think that Representative McPherson threw out to me to represent Ackerman. If you have a person who's actually investigator testifying for the grand jury has a question as to the hearsay they are relating to the grand jury. How does the investigating officer who's testifying to the grand jury respond as to a question that really goes to the hearsay? In other words, being able to cross-examine the person whose report is being offered. I mean, that's what McPherson asked me, and I kind of stumbled on that.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If that becomes a problem, the grand jury can just tell the DA to bring in the other officer, but most of the time they won't need to. And this will not only save money of the jurisdictions, but also save the grand jury and those people a lot of time as well by not having to sit and bring in people one after another. This just, I think, cleans it up. Let's officer testify. If there are any questions, they can take care of that on a case by case basis, which then for the
okay. All right. Council's bringing Representative Anderson up to speed. Representative Anderson, we're going to take a vote on an amendment. Do you feel like you have?
Can I abstain?
Well, you're not allowed to, but you could go last if you wanted to see how it went.
Or go Z to A on the
hey.
Well, I get to go last, actually. We'll take a second to explain it to you. I don't want you to feel like you're in an uncomfortable position, Representative Anderson. Essentially, we had the concern was raised about the grand jury issues, so there were three amendments proposed. We're essentially not really discussing the dash threes because they essentially removed the grand jury discussion entirely from the bill. So the focus is on the twos and the fours. The fours are very narrow in that it limits the ability to have this hearsay evidence admitted to the grand jury solely as it relates to issues involving chain of custody of evidence. So that's really the issue it's the narrowest version while still keeping something in the bill. The dash twos would allow any police officer involved in the specific investigation to testify as to the hearsay. So as Representative Barker said, if he read the Miranda warning to the defendant or the suspect and then turned him over to Representative Przanski, Przanski could then say Representative Barker gave him his Miranda warning at the investigation because Representative Przanski was also an officer in the investigation. So it's not the full step where the DAs wanted to go, but it's sort of the in-between step of where they wanted to go. Right. So is it, committee, do you agree that that's a fair assessment of the amendments?
That was the two.
Those are the twos. Yes. Representative Jensen.
Knowing nothing about grand jury, if I were sitting on the grand jury, do I have the right to ask Representative Przanski if he was there?
Absolutely, yes. You do. Yeah, absolutely.
That's the cross-examination part.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And if you're unsatisfied, as Representative Barker pointed out, you could ask the district attorney to bring Representative Barker in so you could ask him a question. Yeah. Okay, so the motion is on the dash two amendments to House Bill 2865. So I'm going to go ahead and just ask Ann to call the roll on the amendment.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Questioning aye.
That counts.
That's
Representative McPherson?
No.
Representative Kibonsky?
Aye.
Representative Shevlin?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
A quickly decided aye.
Chair Williams?
Correctly. Aye. Okay, the dash two amendment to House Bill 2865 is adopted into the bill. For those of you who were out while we did this, we rescinded the dash one amendment because it's repeated in the dash two with this new language. So the bill is now amended with the dash twos. Representative Prusansky.
I move the bill as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Prusansky moves House Bill 2865 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to vote aye on the measure, but I would like to note that I may change my mind on this on the floor. I'll be happy to inform whoever's carrying the bill that I'm going to do that and the chair of the committee that I'm going to do that before I do.
Appreciate your courtesy. Representative Crummell, you came in at an auspicious moment.
Should I leave again, Mr. Chair?
Well, it's up to you, obviously. But I'm not going to go through it all again because I've gone through it about four times. We adopted Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2865 by a vote of 7-1. Representative McPherson, your desk mate there, being the one vote in opposition. The motion now is to move the bill as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Jensen gave notice that he will support the bill out of committee but reserves his right to change his mind as the bill gets to the floor. So that's where we stand. Representative McPherson?
And, Mr. Chair, I would declare the intention to vote for the bill. In fact, I'd say I was kind of a knife edge about really how important this point was that Representative Prusansky and I had been discussing, and I thought that the Vice Chair's comments about it being a probable cause standard at the grand jury were pretty persuasive, so I will support the bill.
Okay. All right. Good. Why don't we call the roll, Ann?
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Crummell.
Excuse. Aye.
Aye.
Representative Prusansky.
Aye.
Representative Shetterly.
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2865, as amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Anybody want to volunteer to carry the bill? Representative Barker? Okay. House Bill 2756, open a work session.
I think, didn't we just...
Did we do that?
Chairman?
Yeah.
Yes,
well, I got to cross off my list okay. Then. Where am I at, Council? What have I got
left?
Well,
we have 2802, but the amendments are not ready. And I then we have not heard in 2647, and the amendments are the bill, and Scott Taylor is here to address that. It's
which one is that?
2647.
Okay, that's where we need to go.
That's right.
Oh, open a work session there, and we're still going to do colleagues 2094 here in just a minute. So so we've got amendments on
right, Mr. Chairman,
2647. Okay.
And what the amendments do, the Department of Corrections will establish an intensive alternative addiction program. And the program will be based on intensive intervention, rigorous personal responsibility and accountability, physical labor and service to community, and it will have drug treatment and will be evidence-based. Mr. Taylor, Scott Taylor, is here to give you more details.
Scott, you want to come up?
It provides for cognitive restructuring.
Welcome. Why don't you tell us what we need to know?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Scott Taylor, Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Corrections. 2647 is amended. What it allows us to do, we've been operating since 1994 the Summit program, the Dash down in Coos Bay, frequently referred to as the boot camp. We've been operating that program, I guess I'll just say that the Summit program has eligibility restrictions that are set in law and is targeted at the non-major 11 inmates. We've so far had 3,563 inmates who participated in that program and 1,884 have graduated. Yeah. And our research indicates that the Summit graduates have a lower rate of recidivism than a matched control group. Yeah. The average person who recidivates and returns to prison will cost us about $57,000. Additionally, savings are realized from the reduction in a sentence. Right now, the average reduction in sentence is 299 days. That an individual gets for successfully completing the entire program. The program requires 6 months of intensive, rigorous programming that focus on cognitive thinking, military drill, and overall change in criminal thinking. Inmates are then transitioned to the community for a 90-day period where they establish stability and demonstrate behavior changes. And anybody who violates during that 90 days is returned to the institution. Both the time cut and the 90-day transitional leave mean that that individual is not housed in a DOC facility, where the average cost in the 2003-2005 buy-in will be $69.96 a day. Roughly 45% of the DOC inmates have been associated or assessed with a severe substance abuse problem. We have 80% of the folks who come in have alcohol and drug problems. 45 of those we would classify as severe. Evidence-based research indicates that substance abuse is one of the key factors in criminal behavior. The proposed program, as outlined in the Dash 1 amendments, would have the same strict eligibility requirements as the Summit program, but would focus on inmates with substance abuse problems. Addiction treatment will incorporate proven research-based interventions. Inmates will be required to participate in 14 hours of highly structured and regimented routine each day. That's 7 days a week. This would include intensive interventions, rigorous personal responsibility and accountability, physical labor, and service to the community. Additionally, the program would provide cognitive restructuring to enable offenders to confront and correct their criminal thinking problems. The expansion at Powder River Correctional Facility in Baker City will be complete on June 1st. If approved, we anticipate implementing the Intensive Alternative Incarceration Addiction Program in that facility. Our current Intensive Alcohol and Drug Program at Powder River consistently shows a significant reduction in recidivism, and our plan is to build on the effectiveness of that program. Further, DOC is interested in conducting a study of the matched participants to determine what elements of programs impact criminogenic behavior. The more we can learn and actually practice in Oregon, the greater impact we have both on cost of incarceration and recidivism. The Dash 1 amendments would provide the opportunity to closely match the elements of the two alternative incarceration programs, determine the relative impact of the military model that we currently use at the Summit program.
All right. Thank you. Are there questions for Scott? Yes, Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I'm reading the bill where it refers to alternative incarceration, intensive intervention, rigorous personal responsibility and accountability and service to the community, 14 hours of highly structured, regimented routine every day, cognitive restructuring and be at least 270 days duration. That's my legislative job description.
Mr. Chair.
Well, by the time it's over, addiction treatment might be there, too. Representative Przanski.
So, Scott, could you share with us number three, provide 14 hours of highly structured and regimented routine every day, what that entails or is projected to?
In a brief summary, what it basically means is getting up at 6 or so in the morning, the little exercise routine, the ongoing treatment. The way that we have anticipated this program is that we will have both an intense residential program and an intensive day treatment program, both of which by federal standards and even state standards will be classified as residential then. People will spend anywhere from 6 to 8 hours a day then in that kind of treatment, heavy cognitive treatment around alcohol and drug. It also includes a certain amount of labor work where they'll be out in the community or doing work around the institution so many hours a day. And then in the evenings we plan to be back in. They do a variety of group sessions and a variety of ongoing individual work with diaries and charting of thinking errors and that sort of thing. So the idea is that between the work and the treatment, we can keep them fully engaged from about 6 in the morning to 8 at night with meals.
All right. Mr. Chair, follow up if I could.
Yes.
On that basis, from looking at this, our agenda, it says deletes requirement that special alternative incarceration program be based on military basic training model. So what I'm understanding is this is going to have some components, but it's not going to have the military training perspective, but instead put them into more, keep them in rigid formats, but really focus on the behavior modification and skill building for dealing with whatever it may be. So substance abuse problems is not a problem.
Chair Williams and Representative Przanski, the design of this model would be to contrast it in some ways with the Summit model in Coos Bay. So what this model allows us to do is look at the impact of the military model on that change in that recidivism rate. It would focus, yes, on we believe that when we've analyzed most of the practices at the Summit Program, the intensive, focused, cognitive work is one of the main elements that goes on there. So this would allow us to still keep them very highly structured. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
If I could, Scott, I think one of the this committee set through some fairly intensive discussions at the beginning of the session that questioned the viability of of the boot camp model.
That's probably
this original bill would have addressed that issue by just essentially phasing it out. It met with some pretty strong objections from those who are active in that program, not to mention the legislators who come from that part of the state, who are true believers in that concept. So what we're trying to do here with this bill is not only try to develop a targeted cognitive addiction treatment program, which the system desperately needs, but also to contrast it by its structure in a way that would give us a really good one-to-one comparison with the impacts of this program as compared to the military boot camp model program, and allow us to, over time, make some determinations about the successful recidivism impacts. And so it is part of our ongoing effort in this committee to move ourselves towards a what works evidence-based critical analysis of prevention-related programs. Representative Brzezinski.
And I assume so. Hopefully then we'll be able to measure what we heard from the national leaders as to whether what they brought forward does in fact and will work in Oregon.
Right. Really a comparison between a similar cognitive model drawing from the same pool of people not using that model as compared to one using that model, and draw our own comparisons. Because obviously the standard response anytime you want to apply the national data is that we're different than the rest of the nation. Our program is different because of X. Well, it may be, and if it is, this analysis will tell us that. We really are doing almost a blind pool comparison. So it's going to give us, I think, some good information over time. Representative Anderson.
Please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Scott, can you tell me the recidivism rate that you do have at Shutter Creek? Is it generally?
Representative Anderson, a comparison group, the current population control group would be about a 29%, 29.3. This particular population out of the Summit program right now is, I believe, 23%, 23 point something percent. So it does have an impact there.
Good. Can I follow that?
Yeah, you may.
Just a comment. We have a program in, actually it's over in Jackson County called Junior Marines. And it's they're just trying to figure out a way to keep kids out. It's so popular. And it is a military-style training, not with correctional kids, but just kids. And it's taking kids from relatively poor settings and really straightening them out. I think one of the beauties that I see is that as these young men and women come out of it, they're prepared to go on into service to get some backing so they can go on to school where they have money from the service. So to me, it seems like let's not depress the military background type program, but I understand fully the competition that you'd like to see which works best.
Okay, anything further, Representative Crummell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question, Scott. As I read the information here about the original bill and then also in the amendment, I'm getting the feeling that the Shutter Creek program is a one strike and out. And if I'm correct in that, is this going to be designed the same way? When I say one strike and you're out, I don't mean out of prison, but I mean you're out of the program and back into the facility. Is that
Representative Williams, Chair Williams, Representative Crummell? The way the current Summit program works is if you violate while you're in the program or while you're on transition, you are then brought back and reviewed, and based on what kind of violation or what kind of failure you had, you may be put back in and run back through the program, or you may be totally pulled out and put back in population, general population, lose any cut in sentence you had. This would be the same kind of program. The idea is a very stringent, intense program that demands strong participation. We run a program over at Powder River right now that has 50 beds in it, and it turns over a population of people who don't wish to be there or can't deal with it. The same frame of reference would be there. We only want people who really want to deal with their problems and move on. We do try to focus on, over there right now, we try to focus on the highest criminality, highest addiction folks, and have fairly high success.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And this, forgive me if this seems to be off the topic here, but I'm just curious. One of the things that has been reported to me over the course of the last couple of years is that Shutter Creek has had a few walkaways. Is this, if you do have somebody that does walk away, either from Shutter Creek or from this type of a program, do they then automatically go back to the general population, or is there an attempt to try to... how's that dealt with, I guess, is my question.
Chair Williams, Representative Crummell, when we talk about Shutter Creek, I would need to do some checking. There are two programs there. There's both a general population and a specific boot camp population, and so the walkaway, they are treated as escapes. They are then taken back into custody, and we also have, while you're inside the institution working for that 6 months, is one place, and then your 90 days while you're out in a transition, adjusting, working in the community. In both those cases, you are in custody of the Department of Corrections officially, and we would take you back to general population.
Good. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Representative McPherson.
Mr. Taylor, is the level of expense to operate each of these facilities, Shutter Creek in its boot camp format and the proposed new facility, because of the structure involved and the regimentation, is it more expensive than other modes of incarceration within the system?
Chair Williams, Representative McPherson, the initial cost is higher because of the treatment and the staffing. When you factor in the time cut and the transitional leave, they actually reduce the cost per individual considerably. The average savings on both of these programs would be between, for an average inmate would be $23,000 to $24,000 saved.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So $23,000 to $24,000, that would be an annual cost savings per inmate?
Chair Williams, Representative, yes. Well, because of the time cut and the 299-day average time cut that we experience, and because of the 90-day transition, those people are not then in the Department of Corrections cost of $69.96 a day. When you multiply that out and take off the cost of the program, you end up with a net $23,000 roughly savings per individual because they are now out in the community on supervision. Did I get confusing?
Mr. Chair, if I could pursue that further. It sounds as though the savings that you're projecting includes the early release that the individuals get once they've completed the program, if I'm hearing right. If you're comparing the cost of operating the facility for a given stretch of time, having a person in that facility, that the daily cost would be not so different and maybe no less. Am I following that right?
Chair Williams, Representative Pearson, the daily cost of individuals being in these programs is more expensive than a standard housing.
So that the projection of savings includes the expectation that the program will be successful at transitioning them out to the community sooner.
Chair Williams, Representative Pearson, yes.
Okay. Well, I would just raise as a question then whether we're duplicating the facilities. I mean, having Shutter Creek as existing, and then adding a new facility with a different version of more intensive kind of treatment and rehabilitation, in the hopes that we're going to save by earlier release, and having basically these two experimental models running side by side. Whether that expense is one that we ought to be concerned about, I would just offer that as a question, I guess.
Okay. Chair Williams, Representative McPherson, as we've been running the Summit program for about 9 years now, and we have a pool at any given time of about 900 inmates who, after you apply the requirements and the are in that pool. We then narrow that down even further based on behavior inside the institutions, all those sorts of things. So we believe we have a population that can, and the size of the population will be determined by what kind of funding we have to do this. So we believe that we have a population that we can, in fact, populate a portion of the program at Powder River and do a comparison and realize a population that would be successful in earning that time cut. Did I?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right, committee, we have, is there anybody else here to speak to 2647? Okay, we have the Dash 1 amendments in front of us.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Przanski.
I move the Dash 1s into the bill.
Representative Przanski moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2647. Is there a discussion? Objection?
Yeah. Excuse me. Not on the amendments.
Not on the amendments. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Przanski.
I've moved House Bill 2647 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Przanski moves House Bill 2647 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support this bill, but I feel like I need to add for the record an element of caution. That when we do evaluations of programs, to note that of the items really discussed here in the literature that I'm familiar with is about 10 years old, but and I realize a lot changes in 10 years, but the really only topic that survives in multiple regression analysis for preventing recidivism or slowing down recidivism is cognitive restructuring. And I'd caution us not to carry our conclusions out based on some correlations that might appear coming out of the results of these particular activities.
I appreciate the comment, Representative Jensen. I think that obviously we'll look at how this evaluation goes and give it all the weight it's entitled to, I think, once we see the presentation of the impacts after they've had a chance to run it for a while. But like you, I think the cognitive restructuring model has a strong body of evidence-based research to support it, and I think to the extent that we're creating that kind of a model, regardless of Shutter Creek's existence or not, I think it's a positive step in the right direction. And it'll be interesting to look at those recidivism rates and make that evaluation in an interim or future committee opportunity. So the motion is to move the bill as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, let me just offer a comment for what it's worth. I am concerned here that what's happening is we're moving on to another model, which I think is likely more promising than the model that was embraced some years ago when Shutter Creek was conceived. But and I will support this bill, but I'm concerned about us then having a vested stake in old models that we may not have good evidence of whether they work well or not. And in fact, we have heard some evidence that earlier when we were in our informational phase of our work suggest that it was not a good model. So I'm concerned about a sort of a proliferation of surviving models. That said.
Well, you and I share similar concerns, Representative McPherson. It's the old saying of how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. Okay. Representative Przanski.
Let's don't get political here. Elephants, donkeys.
Yeah, all right. Whatever you want to eat, one bite at a time.
I think the other part of this is that hopefully once we get this established and we actually see the two models, maybe what is old that doesn't work can be phased into the better of the models if it turns out to be as true as we
have heard. Or if not, we'll learn from that experience as well. We got to be willing to evaluate the evidence as it comes in. That's the whole idea of moving us towards an evidence-based approach to trying to deal with these issues and base our long-term monetary decisions on this. Now, the motion was to move it to the floor with a due pass, but I want to cross-check with DOC. Needs to go to Ways and Means or not?
Mr. Chair?
Council.
I had a call from Judy James just before the meeting, and she stated the bill does not have a fiscal impact, but it needs to be considered as part of the Department of Corrections budget because it actually, in their analysis, will save money based on the fact that people get out earlier. So they're asking for the bill down there as part of the discussion on the Department of Corrections budget. I mean, this, I can see Claudia Black's eyebrows raised up there. This is part of the, we're in that time of session when things happen very quickly, and I just got this call, like, probably 5 minutes to 12.
Well, if we didn't send it down to them now, they could get it on the Senate side.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's my preference, is that they pick it up on the Senate side. And if they disagree with me on that, then they'll tell me. So I think we're going to stick with the motion of Representative Brzezinski to move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes?
I would just like to toss out for whatever, I guess, also whatever it's worth. One of the things that, one of the dangers that we can very easily run into when we put two programs side by side, two educational theories, if you will, side by side, is that you may find that that they both succeed, and it is very dependent on the selection of the population to go into them. And I think that that's a point that needs to be made, because Shutter Creek and their boot camp style of program may be very successful because of the selection process that people go through before they go into that program, and it's found that they will actually do well in that type of a program. But if you took those same that same population and put them into the program that's contemplated in the present bill, you may find that there's a stark failure. So I think, you know, we just want to be cognizant of the one danger that we can get into when we try to put two programs side by side, that a lot of its success or failure is dependent on the population that's selected to go into that program.
Yeah, thank you, Representative. Okay, and call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Kozlowski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. The bill will move to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd be happy to work on that bill, carry it with an old friend who's a respected retired mayor.
Okay. Are you referencing Representative
Scott Taylor?
Oh, okay. All right. Good.
Mr. Taylor.
Oh, I forgot Mr. Taylor. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Local government guy. Okay.
Good,
very well.
Good golfer, too.
Very well. That takes us then, colleagues, to House Bill 2094. I'll open a work session on that bill. I ask Pete Shepard from the Department of Justice to come forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. When I appeared first on this bill on, I think it was April 8th, I indicated to the committee that what we were trying to do was to find consensus where it was possible to do so and to identify the policy choices for the committee where it was not possible to do so. I think we're making some progress. There are two basic issues that currently are separating us from the possibility of a consensus proposal for the committee. The second issue, one of those issues, is whether to add into the bill something called an allocable share cap, and I won't bore you with the details unless you want to ask questions about it this afternoon, but you have some materials have been submitted to the committee on that question. from the National Association of Attorneys General, and I should indicate just for the record that I didn't distribute those to the committee, although I think they may be useful. I don't know who did distribute them, but those didn't come from us. On that issue, we have reached a degree of consensus to this extent. The disputants on that issue have agreed to take that matter up in the Senate. So that issue won't be the subject of proposed amendments to House Bill 2094. The second issue that is still of a concern is in Section 11 of what are the Dash 2 amendments that you have before you. And it concerns an element of Line 15, which relates to the scope of the remedy provided in this bill. And from the Department of Justice's standpoint, we're concerned that as drafted, it may open a very broad loophole. And I think if we had one more day to work with legislative counsel on that language, we could present a squared-away policy choice for the committee on the issues presented by that section of the bill. So that would be the primary portion of the Dash 2 amendments that the committee would have to make a policy choice on.
Pete, couldn't we just strike the words "in this state" conceptually on page 11?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that would accomplish what that would frame the policy issue, and I the Department of Justice would support that. Let me indicate to the committee that I've made the commitment to those who would like to see that language stay in, that I will work with them to try and accommodate their concerns about the elimination of that language.
Okay, so this isn't just a drafting error. This is a whole new policy discussion that I haven't had a chance to talk about with either the participating master settlement agreement companies or the non-participating companies. Is that right?
Mr. Chair,
actually arose between the time I walked into the hearing room and we're hearing this bill right now.
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Taylor's observed it's the time of session when these things arise quickly. These amendments were just available to us about 11:30 this morning, I think. So.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that probably makes some sense. Let me take a you state where you put for a second, Pete, and I'll try to bring the committee up to speed with what I understand. And I haven't had any discussion about that. That's a brand new issue. But essentially, without making you endure what Pete could give us was a probably 5-day lecture about the settlement agreement. There are various kinds of tobacco companies, and they're the ones, the big ones, that all were participants in the master settlement agreement. And then there's a group of companies called the non-participating manufacturers, which are smaller companies that also sell product to varying degrees within Oregon and in some areas. Some sell in lots of states, some don't sell in very many states, and there's lots of different kinds of those. There was some issues about the balance in these amendments as to whether they mistreated one particular, whether the NPMs, the non-participating manufacturers, would be treated poorly by the way the amendments were being written, or at least a category of those were being treated poorly. So there was an effort to try to come together on some amendments. This business about allocable share, that was my suggestion we not work in this committee because, A, of its complexity and the lateness of the time, because this bill does need to move through. I'm right, Pete, about that.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. This is an important bill.
Yeah, this is an important bill for the state's master settlement agreement issues, and so this bill does need to move. So I said, let's not kill ourselves arguing about a very complicated issue of allocable share, which literally has only come up for me in the last probably 36 hours or less. Let's move it to the Senate. You guys can argue about the allocable share issue in the Senate, and this committee will get an opportunity by a concurrence or a non-concurrence when it comes back across as to what we want to do on that issue. And if we don't like what the Senate does, we can always bump the thing into a conference committee and have the conversation there. This issue, though, this new one about in this state, is just a brand new issue. So my hope was originally, colleagues, that we'd have a consensus bill, and then my hope was that we'd agree to disagree, at least on one part of the bill, but that agree to have that fight in the Senate. And since lunchtime, even that's gone sideways. So that brings you up to speed a little bit about what the posture of this issue is. Pete, have you gone over generally what it is. If you brief the committee generally about what this bill does.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I haven't done so orally. I distributed written testimony last time. I'd be happy to give you a brief description of the general concepts of the bill that would be applicable to any of the versions that you're looking at.
Can you put it into about, you know, just maybe a minute, if you had to describe this to one of your little kids, what this is attempting to accomplish?
Mr. Chair, I would say what the chair said before about the bill is how it would be described. I think you did a good job of capturing it. The gist of the non-participating manufacturer statute is to place a financial, the public purpose of it is to place a financial burden on manufacturers who were not part of the original settlement agreement and who have chosen not to join it subsequently, to place a burden that approximates the economic burden that they would endure if they were participating manufacturers. The public purpose behind that statute is to remove any disincentive from staying outside of the framework of the Master Settlement Agreement. In other words, to create inducements for people to join the Master Settlement Agreement, because within that framework, those manufacturers have agreed to restrictions on marketing to kids and other forms of marketing restrictions that serve the public health interest. So the idea of the non-participating manufacturer statute is simply to impose an economic burden on those who do not participate that approximates the burden that they would assume if they did participate. And what this bill does is beef up the enforcement tools available to the state of Oregon to help make sure that non-participating manufacturers fully comply with their obligations under that statute, and thus to serve the public purpose of removing any disincentive to stay outside the framework of the Master Settlement Agreement.
Okay, thank you, Pete. There are questions for Pete about the general sense of what this is trying to accomplish? Okay. Here's what I was just talking to council, and so here's what we're going to do, because this is a new issue and one that we haven't heard anything about. I'm going to go ahead and have him set the bill. We couldn't get it set for tomorrow, even if we wanted to. So we're going to set the bill for Friday to at least address this issue that's been raised now about the in this state issue, and to allow the parties who care about this bill to frame the discussion with the committee as to what the policy choices they're going to have to make. And that will allow Mr. Shepard to work with legislative council in getting amendments drafted that would take care of that. So we're all going to live the tobacco settlement discussions for the next 2 days, and so you just ought to at least prepare a couple hours on your calendar between now and the Friday hearing to try to get a handle on it. If there aren't any questions for Mr. Shepard, then I'll go ahead and let you go, Pete, and we'll just plan on seeing you back at the committee on Friday to have a more thorough briefing. I am going to invite Mr. Koba and his client to come up and talk to the committee, and then I'm going to invite, after that, either Mr. Gardner or Mr. Linden, representing the participating settlement folks, to come up and put a couple of comments on the record. And then we'll all go back to our corners and wait for the title bout on Friday. Marshall?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Marshall Koba, representing the Council of Tobacco, Council of Independent Tobacco Manufacturers of America. And with me is Dave Redman, the CEO of Carolina Tobacco, which is a Portland-based company. Sitting on members are, we are the compliant members, the MPMs, as was just outlined by Pete Shepard. We came here today to support the Dash 2 amendments, and the in the state language was unexpected to us. But we appreciate the opportunity that we've had to work with the work group headed up by Pete Shepard. We are pleased with the outcome of the work group, as several onerous provisions in the original bill have been amended. We were not able to get all of our amendments proposed to be adopted into the Dash 2s, but we support its adoption by the committee. House Bill 2094 with the Dash 2 amendments will allow our members to compete in a fair and balanced business climate in Oregon. The bill, with the assistance of the AG staff and of the work group, is a fair bill, and we urge your support. If passed by this legislature, House Bill 2094 will continue a trend across the country of states adopting legislation that contains language that takes into account the concerns of our members. Thank you.
Thank you, Marshall. Welcome.
Thank you.
Do you need to say anything or add anything?
Well, if I may comment on one specific issue that yes. was discussed here today.
Please do. And put your name on the record for us.
I am David Redmond.
Right.
I am president and owner of Carolina Tobacco Company based in Portland, Oregon. I think we're the only tobacco company cigarette distributor in Oregon. We do business in 42 states. And we try our best to stay in touch with the attorneys general regarding all legislation in the 46 participating states. With that background and experience, if I may comment, Chair Williams and representatives, regarding the page 11 on the dash 2 in this state, I'd like to comment that a number of states have passed legislation that are referred to as the complementary master settlement legislation. And in those states, in fact, the same language or in principle, the same language as is stated in Dash 2 is currently in Dash 2, that is, has been passed by the states. And the question, as I see it, is what happens to the state of Oregon if a distributor or a freight company warehouse has product unstamped, that is, without the cigarette tax stamps affixed to it, sitting in a warehouse? And I suggest that states such as Oregon, Idaho, and most others have passed legislation that says it is illegal to affix a tax stamp to a cigarette product that is not in compliance. So therefore, if we have a distributor, for example, in Portland, who stamps multiple states, let's say Washington, Idaho, and Oregon, if the product is not compliant in Oregon, and the distributor is stamping the product for Washington or Idaho, then I believe that they're in compliance, and I don't believe that the state of Oregon would then be damaged. So, therefore, on that basis and the basis of my experience, I recommend to the committee, Chair Williams, that the Dash 2 be passed as is.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Redmond. Questions? And we'll look forward to either hearing from you or from Marshall on Friday as we dig into this issue deeper. Thanks, Marshall.
Thank you.
Thank you. Who drew the short straw, Gardner or Linden? Both.
How lucky we are.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, representing Philip Morris. We agree with you, Mr. Chair, that we'll address the allocable share language on the Senate side and then bring back to you whatever the work product is of that. The issue of in this state is an important one, and I would characterize that as a error. I think Mr. Shepard would agree that the intent of the Attorney General was to capture cross-border sales. And if the committee has any question about that, or if I'm in error about that, I would like to be corrected at this time. But I believe that the intent of the Attorney General in preparing this draft was to capture cross-border sales from warehouses and other venues in the state of Oregon to whatever number of states might be the destination of those. And I think it's extremely important for law enforcement purposes that be the cross-border sales fall within the ambit of this bill, so that there's not a risk that they would be exempt somehow and thus not within the purview of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Bill Linden representing R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company. I don't want to be repetitive. Mr. Gardner summed it up. We think that language absolutely has to come out so that it's clear that the intention is to be able to effectively enforce cross-border sales, which is an important issue in this particular bill. So, with that, I'd be happy to try and respond to any questions.
Well, I think it would be helpful as we have to noodle this over between now and Friday to really understand what you guys know all this fancy cigarette lingo that some of us lack. So explain to us what it is you're trying, what you think removing the language in this state is going to allow to happen. In other words, mechanically, what does that mean? Does it mean that then that if they are audited and they've got these cigarettes on the floor, that it counts to their percentage of market share? I mean, how does this thing mechanically work so we understand the real policy choice we're making if we leave that language in or if we take it out? And what do you think the reason for including it would be?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe that the reason for the consequence would be that the penalties of this law, the full gambit of penalties, which are enumerated and which Mr. Shepherd is better equipped to describe than me, would apply to cross-border sales of contraband material. The consequence of leaving it out is that they would not. And it would only affect intrastate sales.
Maybe it's just that you're at the last of the agenda and I'm having trouble wrapping my brain around it. But, Mr. Richmond, you want to respond to that as well? What do you think the negative effect for your business is if we take out the words in this state?
Chair Williams, not to correct you, I'm Redmond, sort of like the Microsoft Redmond in Washington, but that's all right.
There's a Redmond Oregon, too.
My apologies.
It's all right. The impact is as follows, and I speak with some experience. In the state of New York, for example, there is a transit warehouse by a freight company, and our product came into that warehouse. And under a provision which is now being changed in New York, our product was considered to be contraband. So what I'm saying is that the problem here is that a multi-state distributor will legally and legitimately have a product in their warehouse that is, let's say, non-compliant in Oregon because that may be their choice. But it is compliant in, say, Idaho and Washington. They are legally stamping for those two states, but the facility, the domicile, is in Oregon. And if the in this state is removed and some other language put in there, and I suggest that other lobbyists may say a very strict language which says it's immediately contraband and can be seized, that this is an economic hardship to the distributor, and it's unfair.
Okay, because I don't know much about tobacco distribution, so let me see if I can walk through this. If you are a tobacco distributor and you're getting product from a manufacturer and you've got it in your warehouse and you're going to distribute multi-state, you'll be putting either the Oregon tax stamp or the Washington tax stamp or an Idaho tax stamp. Let's use those examples. You're saying that if we take out the in this state language, what it means is that the product that you have in your warehouse that you intend to ship in southern Idaho would, at least until you got it out of the state, if it were captured, be considered contraband because it didn't have an Oregon stamp on it?
Yes, that is my interpretation. That's my understanding. And I see the heads nodding here. In fact, it becomes illegal to effectively possess, hold, or otherwise have the goods. Let me give you one other quick example. Let's say the product arrives in Oregon and tomorrow, and today the state considers the brand as non-compliant as an NPM. Now, tomorrow, let's say that the distributor wants to return it to the vendor. But under taking this state out, the moment that the brand is not in compliance, it can be seized and will be contraband.
Mr. Chairman, I think I do understand the problem, I think this language, taking it out, sweeps too broadly, and I think what Mr. Shepherd has suggested, that there's a way of crafting an amendment that would essentially capture the rule that exists in the destination of the distribution and make that not automatic. If the rule is different than Oregon, make that perhaps not automatically contraband. What I would suggest is that's a far cry from a broad sweep of exempting, in effect, all cross-border sales.
Okay. So, Representative Przanski?
Yeah, it sounds to me that potentially there's an interstate commerce issue here. I mean, if we have product just basically making a stop here before it goes to the next, it's almost like how much regulation can we do
Well, the issue is that the non-participating manufacturer, there are multiple kinds, I think, but there are at least two kinds of non-participating manufacturers. In other words, those who didn't sign on to the master settlement agreement. There are those who are actually complying with the state's rules, and they're posting their bonds, and they're putting up their money, and they're paying their fees, and they're doing the thing. And then there's sort of this group of less, and I mean no disrespect, sir, to your industry, but a less reputable group, perhaps, who are not living by the rules or complying. And they're coming in, and they're potentially moving product into the state as well. What we're really talking about, if I understand it right, is we're talking about what the state gets to do. So Oregon has product from a, you know, if our people get their hands on product from a non-compliant, non-participating manufacturer, they could grab it because and seize it as contraband because they aren't complying with Oregon's law and participation. Now, his point is that if you're simply the middleman on this, and the product was never destined for Oregon, and it's just moving through the warehouse, then, you know, should you be able to seize that product if it was never meant to go to the Oregon market, but it was going to go to Idaho, where maybe they are or aren't compliant with what Idaho has said? And I think that, have I summed the issue appropriately, Pete? And so what Jim is suggesting, what Mr. Gardner maybe is suggesting, is that if you do a look back in the statute and say, well, okay, you can only do to it what Idaho could do to it, if they're compliant in Idaho, then maybe you do nothing. If they're not compliant in Idaho, then you get to do something. That might be a middle ground.
Okay.
But again, the only reason we're not ready to do anything today, the only reason I'm taking us through this discussion is we got to get educated about it because we're going to have to make a policy choice here in about 48 hours.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, what I would suggest is that you empower Mr. Shepard to attempt to craft something that's that is along the line of what I suggested that essentially gives a destination role.
Hold on a second, Jim. All right, did that work, Pete? Okay, good. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Perfect spiral.
All right. I think that's all of our business for today, so I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2094, and we're going to close the public hearing on, the committee for the afternoon.